Hello, and welcome to Due Signori in Giallo, with me, Dave Thomas, and John Deere. This time, we set our sights on London via the twisted brain wrong of Lucio Fulci in 1971's splattery classic, A Lizard in a Woman's Skin, aka Una Luciatola con la Pelle di Donna. Please join us.
Julia Dura was murdered by the person she was blackmailing. Only she wasn't blackmailing your son-in-law.
Paul, there's only one thing I can tell you. I didn't kill her.
She was standing there in front of me, in her fur coat. So, she takes it off. Not a bloody stitch on.
Mrs. Hammond, remember that anything you say will be taken down and may be given in evidence.
Spoiler warning, and this movie is a doozy, so it's definitely one that's worth going and checking out before coming back and listening to us ruin all of the third act reveals. And content warning for sexualized violence, suicide, drug use, gaslighting, animal cruelty, and some fairly extreme gore.
Lizard in the Woman's Skin.
I bet it doesn't have any vivisected dogs in it.
Well, Anthony Asquith film we're going to watch.
Anthony Asquith's Lizard in the Woman's Skin.
We're going to discuss that, I imagine, in due course. But although we joke of the absurdity of Anthony Asquith's Lizard in a Woman's Skin, it's not necessarily obvious that Fulci should be doing Giallo, is it? Now, we've covered Fulci before. We've done him for Don't Torture a Duckling. But that's a very different for the reasons mentioned at the time, not least of which it's rural setting in here. But for those of us, like me, with a more basic knowledge of Italian, particularly Italian genre, Fulci is all about grotty gore, bodily fluids melting, unconvincing spiders and gateways to hell. Why? But so that's sort of like late '70s, early 80s. But here in this, we have, despite its London setting, a very giallo.
Well, we've done Fulci twice. Don't forget.
Oh, have we?
He also did One on Top of the Other.
Yes,
or Perversion Story.
Indeed, yes. I had forgotten.
Which is his first giallo.
Yeah. So is this one example of several at the time, or?
Well, yeah. So this is the second one. This came on the heels of One on Top of the Other, which had been successful. This is kind of pivotal, I think, in a number of ways, because whilst it was being developed and in production in this kind of same time that the inevitable mention of Bird with Crystal Plumage coming out. So this was being written and kind of put together as Bird with Crystal Plumage was in production. And ultimately then that was released and this came out subsequently. So one of the things it affected is the title. It was originally written under the title The Cage, which is not very interesting, but obviously when as Crystal Plumage came out and became,
isn't that the pilot of Star Trek?
It is the original Star Trek pilot. Yes. So yeah, as this kind of shifted, and as everything sort of seismically shifted in the Italian thriller genre after Crystal Plumage, and everyone had to put like an animal's name in the title. Mm. Thus, this became initially Woman with a Snake Skin, and then finally came out as Lizard in a Woman's Skin. That said, because of the time that it was being produced, the things that kind of stand out, apart from some of the, you know, the elements of the, you know, camera work and all of the things that are quite striking about it. Like, even Fulci hadn't gone to this level with the kind of gore and bloodletting and okay. kind of extremity that's in this before. So this is, and certainly not in one on top of the other. And he had, so in a little bit in a film, I think the Italian pronunciation is Beatrice Cenci, which is a historical drama that has some kind of fairly graphic torture going on in it. But then this is really where he kind of goes all out with, I mean, you know, the, literally to the point where he was prosecuted in the British courts for animal cruelty, and poor Carlo Rambaldi had to turn up to court with one of the fake dogs to show how it was done. Because
we'll come on to the scene, sorry, where that was necessary. But yes. Would you not have? I wondered if that was an urban myth, because presumably, before it got to court, would you not say, during the investigation, would you not say, no, here's a prop of an eviscerated dog?
But, well, apparently it happened. So, So yeah, it's definitely a shift. And then after this, so we've talked about at some considerable length, we talked about Don't Torture a Duckling, and it's I think that film and this film are really the sort of shift between, because Fulci carried on doing other things for a little while. You know, he was never a horror specialist the way that Argento always was, until the point where he was doing things like Zombie Flesh Eaters and The Beyond and City of the Living Dead, isn't it?
Yes.
Where he just kind of became known as like the gore meister, and then struggled to do anything else. And then even, you know, his sort of subsequent Giallo, the most infamous one, New York Ripper, is very notable for the sort of extreme kind of sadistic level of the violence in it. I know that some of it kind of relates to his personal life. He'd had the sort of tragic suicide of his first wife, who he was apparently very devoted to, and his second wife, and he had quite a troubled relationship, and it seems to there seems to be a shift in his attitude towards his female characters in this kind of time frame where he kind of the suggestion is he kind of hates them all, and there's a lot of discussion around that of the people that work with him sort of said what his actual attitude was and whether he was just like hated everybody. So yeah, this is kind of almost the starting point of that Fulci,
right? Okay,
which is interesting. And of course, he then takes some umbrage at sort of Argento getting the credit for that shift, because as far as he was concerned, he was doing his thing on the basis of films that came before Argento.
Okay, we're very obviously in London for the moment. We have covered it so far, but hardly stereotypical. Unlike other places, we are meant to be in London.
Yep.
We're not. This is not being passed off as Milan like last time. why are we in London?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just kind of going back to the traditional sort of giallo approach of like Italy's is not very interesting, and the classic gialli thing to do is go to somewhere that's seen as sort of quite glamorous and swinging. And I suppose this is like 71, being developed in 70, so it's the very, you know, it's a tail end of the swinging London thing. I think also because Fulci, I think, was sort of really quite ambivalent to issues of class and your sort of haves and have-nots, and you see that really come out in Don't Torture a Duckling, which is all about, you know, sort of rural superstition versus sort of the urban trendies kind of coming into town or kind of passing through these sort of very rural areas. And I think London sort of makes it quite a good setting to have this very well-to-do, almost kind of aristocratic protagonist, and among the causes of her trauma is kind of shit counterculture. Because, you know, in essence, you know, she's brung low by a sort of combination of permissive, you know, permissive society, free, you know, free love, and bloody hippies. And the there's a distinction. I mean, you get the sense from Fulci that he doesn't really like any of them.
No, you don't. But there's an interesting almost delay. This is quite a 60s film. Anyway, it harks back to sort of things that Gerry O'Hara did with sort of things like The Pleasure Girls. Obviously, yes. There's more naked. It's a different time. So there's a lot more nudity and overt sexuality, and certainly more violence than there was in those films. But you've got the sense that, you know, a bit after the time, we're in 71 now, so it's a bit after the time where you would be sort of arguing the dangers of love. What's the one with Linda Marlowe, that kind of girl? They're those sorts of, it's harking back to those sorts of things, saying that, you know, young and free love is dangerous. And I think, but they're doing it in sort of a glamorous way, because the Italians are going, yeah, but it's much cooler, isn't it? It's much fun to do it. And you have that contrast to where they're all having around having dinner in a slightly boring, staid, very British way, while cutting to the orgy taking place next door. And you've got sort of like the idea that the daughter, and it has to be the daughter, obviously, is like toe tapping to the music she can hear, and she wants to join. And then you've got at the end, you've got what's his name plays the dad, Leo Genn, who's sort of British character actor, sort of going out in a bit of a huff. They had listened to these young people, while then getting into the car that his chauffeur has been sat presumably for about 6 hours, just waiting for him to take him home. That interesting level of privilege. But it seems like it's harking back to sort of films 5, 6, 7 years before that were being made by Brits as a sort of warning to the younger generation. But from a different perspective, from an Italian perspective, a slightly more fun and probably, let's say, irresponsible perspective compared to the British counterparts.
Yeah, but then interesting. So you mentioned the Joan, the daughter, is kind of, you know, sort of, oh, that sounds quite fun, but and everyone else is very sort of straight laced and disapproving. But of course, one of the people who is straight laced and disapproving has actually experienced the counterculture firsthand, and it's all a facade. And I think that's what kind of Fulci's getting at. It's like the decay of
the realization and the drug usage that comes with that as well. You will die. However, I toyed with saying this when I first met, but it makes it look so cool for 7/8 of the film. Yes. You will have sex with phenomenally beautiful women. Oh, by the way, but your life will go over drugs. I was thinking, yeah, but I'd do that. It's a bit like, do you want to live 20 years longer? Well, yeah, but I don't. If I died at 80, do I really want to live from the age of 80 to 100? Is that going to be fun? It will be unpleasant if you have these drugs all that time as well. Yeah, but look at the way. Look at her. She'll come up to me like, no, I'm staying here. This is all right. This is quite fun. I think it loses that moralistic message in its in its rather sexually adventurous hedonism that it presents, and also if I want moralizing from a film, I'm not sure I go to Fulci. Apparently we should really hate women and kill them in some very violent visceral ways. That's why everything I've learned about feminism, I learned from
Lucio Fulci. Amazing.
Should probably do a précis of the plot. I mean, good luck.
Indeed, yes. This one's quite complex, and I will have to give the full spoiler warning, because this is kind of a doozy.
Yeah, if you've never seen this, I will. We haven't actually.
Go away.
This is really good. It is a really good film. Yes. It does leave you guessing. It is a whodunit. Did she? What's real and what isn't? And it keeps you guessing. And crucially, that we'll come on to, it stars a very well-known British actor as the coppers, and the coppers in this one aren't incompetent.
Yes, 100%. Yeah. That's the kind of the real, probably the biggest head spin from a typical giallo is that they actually work it out.
It hasn't got the outsider coming in
No, it doesn't.
It's more police procedural. The other lead man, our friend John Sorrell. What was he in? He was in not Sweet Body of Deborah, was it? It was.
He was in One on Top of the Other, which is the previous.
He's been another one we've seen as well, hasn't he?
Yes, he's in. He is the dead body on the table in Short Night of Glass Dolls.
Oh, of course, yes, he is. That's really hard. As well, and also probably best known as well for generally well known probably for Belle de Jour, Dare the Jackal. He's in as well, isn't he? Yeah, as well.
Absolutely.
Anyway, so we'll come on to the very good cast and to why this works. But if you want to just give us a quick rundown of very convincing attacking swans.
Yes. Well, so I will just mention as well. So the soundtrack with this one is the great Ennio Morricone, and he does do a lot of there's some really quite beautiful themes in this. But his kind of psychedelic freak out music with the kind of bass line that's all over the place. Every time I hear that, I just think, you know, the bit in Spinal Tap when when Nigel Tufnell leaves,
yes,
and they have to become a jazz rock fusion instrumental band. Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
It's like, you're a witness to the birth of Spinal Tap, Mark II. this reminds me. Anyway, totally aside. Yeah, so it opens with a dream sequence, one of several. And so the main character's name is Carol Hammond. She is played by Florinda Balkan, who we've seen a couple of times now, in Don't Talk to Your Duckling and, of course, Footprints on the Moon. So she is rammed into a train full of naked people. I did write down something like London, Northwestern in Rush Hour. And anyway, so she's sort of in this is sort of slightly disturbing, psychedelic kind of corridor where she's sort of hemmed in by all these naked, slightly dead looking people. As she comes out of that, she encounters a beautiful naked woman played by Anita Strindberg. So Anita Strindberg is playing a character we will come to learn is called Julia Durer, who's actually a neighbour of Florinda Balkan's character. And they have this very exquisitely shot sort of slow-mo sex scene. Florinda Balkan's wearing this grey fur coat and it's sort of being blown by wind, but I think in reverse it has this really extraordinary effect. And this is actually the only scene that the Italian censors made them cut down because of hints of oral sex. They had to remove. So that's
oral sex from a woman. We should
yes,
not by the blowjobs, practically compulsory. Yeah. All of that,
yes.
It?
You know, the gore and the murder and all of that they were fine with, but you know, anyway. So it's kind of hot and heavy dream. Carol, Florinda Balkan, wakes up. She's then describing her dream to her psychiatrist, who is played by the inevitable Jorge Rigaud, who we saw in All the Colours of the Dark, playing pretty much the same character,
yes,
in the same setting. So it's like, oh, you know, potential shared universe is the same, because he survives this one, he dies in that one. And so she's describing this dream and he's saying, because it's the kind of, you know, 70s psychoanalytics that is sort of movie nonsense. So he's kind of, you're seeing her as in the guise of a stripper or a prostitute, which is an image of vice that both repels and attracts you.
Does
and,
it?
You know,
oh,
you,
no, sorry.
Yes. Yeah. Not less of the repulsion. And you sort of, he's telling her she has to overcome it, which again seems, you know, why, but anyway, the scene that you described, which is she's at home. So her father is a guy called Edmund Brayton, who's a famous barrister who's potentially going into politics, and her husband, that is Leo Genn, the British character actor. Her husband Frank, played by Jean Sorel, has a job in the law chambers of her dad, and they're all having dinner. That they also have a friend who seems to sort of kind of live around their house a lot of the time. Whose name is Deborah, played by Sylvia Monti, and her husband Frank has a daughter by a previous marriage, whose name is Joan, Joan is played by an actress named Edie Galliani. The first choice was apparently the princess from Flash Gordon, Ornella Muti. But I couldn't get Ornella Muti, so Edie Galliani is actually terrific. So, and as you said, they're trying to have this very sort of stuffy, straight-laced, you know, sort of upper-class dinner, but there's a literal orgy going on next door. And as you say, you know, and it's causing particular stress for Carol. Edmund, her dad, seems to be treating it all a bit of a joke. Sort of, oh, what on earth are they doing? And anyway, so eventually he leaves. And as you said, the chauffeur's been there for like 3 days, just waiting in the car, peeing in a bottle. One thing I did like here, there's actually a scene in the law chambers. And this movie has some interesting use of famous locations, let's just say that. But they do actually film the exterior of the law chambers at the Inns of Court around Temple Church. Indeed, so yes. the centre of, you know, barristerism in the UK. So they did do some sensible location scouting. Edmund, the dad, gets a mysterious phone call from somebody claiming her name is Mrs. Smith, who is threatening to who's trying to blackmail him about someone in his family having an affair. And he puts Frank on the spot and asks if he's being unfaithful, which he denies. Of course he is. He's actually sleeping with the friend that's around their house all the time. Deborah. I like that her signifier is it like a Lotus 7 that's sort of painted in like psychedelic colors or something? So it's like, you know, anyway, so they're having an affair on a dark and stormy night, of course. Now, this is the crucial bit. Carol has another dream in which she now sees sort of family members as part of a very kind of scary pet, and there's lots of kind of art around her flat that is now kind of feeding into the dreams. I think it's like a sort of Francis Bacon type prints of, you know, a big swan with a vaginal opening and a, you know, sort of dead family around a dinner table. And then the kind of hot and heavy lesbian action carries on. The running of the fingers through the luxurious fur coat is obviously very symbolic. But then Carol stabs Julia quite graphically and gorily to death. And then at the end of that sequence, as she's sort of being chased by this phantom goose that's also on one of the paintings, she sees these two hippies watching her from a balcony who appear to be dead. And
they do so look a bit like the makeup. It's a bit like The Beyond, isn't it?
It is very much like The Beyond.
That Fulci's likes that, you know.
Yeah, they got these very dead kind of staring eyes, which is quite an important telling point later on. We'll come back to that. Anyway, so she's explaining this again to a psychiatrist, and he thinks that she's resolved the conflict by, in her dream, murdering this symbol of vice that attracts and repels her. Only
when she wakes up,
Julia Dura has actually been stabbed to death. And at this point, we have the next sort of big acting coup of the film, which is the great Stanley Baker from Zulu. And
it is Stanley Baker.
It's a major, would be from TV
and now to film star.
As Inspector Corvin. And I also like his sidekick is Alberto de Mendoza, who we've now seen about 3-4 times. And he was also in One on Top of the Other. Last time we saw him, he was the, you know, duplicitous husband in Strange Vice of Mrs. Ward. And this is, it's got a slightly thankless role in this. He just plays like the sergeant sidekick, Sergeant Brandon. So he gets to hang out with Stanley Baker a bit, but that's fine. I will also point out, I'm not sure the actor's name is, but the guy who, Ezio Morano, who plays the guy from the scientific squad.
Oh, yes. Slightly odd forensics guy.
Who Stanley Baker seems to hate, and actually seems to hate most people in the film. But the reason I mention it is I think both him and I think John Sorrell have been revoiced by Robert Rieti, who's the guy who used to do all the Bond villains in like the 60s Bond. So it's him when you're hearing like Adolfo Celli and Gert Frobe in the Bond films. It's always him that's doing the revoicing. So I think that's him. He's got quite a recognisable voice. Anyway, I couldn't find any confirmation, but that's how I think it is. Anyway, obviously the night of the murder was the same night that Frank was off with having his dalliance. So there's a sort of suspicion kind of falls on him. The murder weapon was a paper knife that belongs to Carol. So obviously that's now missing. And Frank goes to see the body, which, you know, is a little bit, whilst it's still in situ. But Inspector Corbin is like, okay, well, you know, not sure why, but, you know, that seems interesting. And of course, the crime scene is exactly like the dream. And there's this whole sort of subplot about the scarf and the boots that Julia Durer are wearing when she's murdered. Okay. Strap in. She goes off to their big sort of country pile to kind of take her mind off it. They have this sort of strange scene where there's a red-haired Irish guy who gives a false confession, which doesn't then seem to relate back to anything, even though red-headed guys is a plot point. He doesn't seem to have any sort of future bearing. We also get some interesting sort of British character actors in here. So the police commissioner is played by Basil Dignam, who's another sort of British character actor.
Did I see in one of the backgrounds Tony Adams from
Tony Adams is, yes, is in this as well. Yeah, he's the guy that gets like shouted at for bringing in the wrong suspect.
That's right. Yeah, that's from
Tony Adams is in The Green Death.
I was going to go Crossroads. But yes, in 18 months' time, he would be appearing in a very good Doctor Who. And he doesn't die, even though he's supposed to, because he got ill during production and had to be replaced.
There we go. Mm.
He plays Elgin, who's sort of the one at Global Chemicals with a conscience. Mm. And he's meant to be bumped off in episode 5. But in episode 4, the act, because they were recording 2 episodes a fortnight, the actor got, the actor got ill and had to be replaced at race minutes by Dalek voice Roy Skelton. Him that gets killed.
Well, Tony Adams is on one of the Blu-ray extras for this, and he said that that Stanley Baker was an absolute twat.
Fair enough.
Which is quite. But
I really imagine, you know, Tony Adams saying that as well.
Yeah. But anyway, so now the investigation is kind of ramping up. Carol is in a shop and she sees the bloody hippies outside. So they fought, and she's with the daughter Joan. So they go to their squat. It's I believe it's an abandoned theater that they're actually filming in. Joan goes to talk to them and they said, "Oh yeah, we go to parties at Julia's house all the time." But Carol kind of runs off before talking to them for reasons which will be revealed. Anyway, the science squad guy now reveals that from their investigation, the murder was on a dark and stormy night, the footprints of the killer were from shoes that weren't wet. Therefore, the killer had to have been inside the building already, which kind of then throws more suspicion on Carol. They also managed to engineer getting one of her fingerprints and find one on the knife, which they've obviously found. So she's arrested. They bail her out. There's a great bit where they leave the court and Stanley Baker and Alberto de Mozo are very clearly standing on the steps outside the Royal Albert Hall. But, you know, it's fine. but some of the location work is quite comical. And then the psychiatrist, back with Jorge Rigard, says that, well, if you did kill Julia, because you dreamt it, clearly it was unconscious, and thus there's a precedent in another famous case where you could be acquitted because you didn't know what you were doing. But the only thing that sort of seems to be a real element that might relate to the crime is that the hippies might have really witnessed it because they're in the dream. Okay, yeah. So this is important, and of course at this point it's sort of revealed that Frank has been sleeping with Deborah and the dad now discovers that is the case. Carol is now kind of checked into this strange sort of hospital, mental hospital.
Yeah,
it's not really clear. And she's sort of been abandoned out, you know, sitting in a lawn chair outside. And she sees the male hippie that from her dream, who's another red-haired guy, which doesn't relate to the other red-haired guy for some reason. But anyway, and he's sort of hanging around menacingly and he chases her into the hospital. And as she's trying to escape, she runs into a room and that's where she finds these three vivisected dogs.
Who are not dead.
Who are not dead.
Their hearts are beating, even though they're a good 7 inches out of their bodies.
Yes. Which is the bit that apparently caused the legal trouble, because on a sort of old film print, it looks more convincing than it does on Blu-ray. But it's still pretty nasty. And it's sort of, it's a little bit apropos of nothing almost. I mean, I've seen sort of some interpretation of it as it's kind of her, you know, is there a breakdown in her mind between sort of what's real and what's imagined? And this is sort of going back to the wounds of on Julia's body, because she is sort of kind of sliced unpleasantly, you know, sort of fairly graphically down the middle. I don't know about that, but I think it's, you know, I think it's like it's some gory bits just to freak you out. And she passes out and then, you know, wakes up later on. Edmund, the dad, now knows, having had this call, he now knows that Frank was having an affair. And it seems like the blackmail call actually came from the murdered woman, Julia. And so now he's thinking, well, Frank probably murdered Julia because Carol used to write down what her dreams were so that she could remember them to tell to the psychiatrist. And therefore, Frank could have found that and staged the murder accordingly. And with that kind of idea now seeded, Carol gets released, goes back to their kind of big country house. And then the female hippie shows up and says, come and meet me at this church. So she goes to the church, but where is it, John?
It's Alexandra Palace.
It's Alexandra. You've been there, haven't you?
Well, for a start, I'm just over a mile away from it as I sit here. In upstairs in my home in Muswell Hill, but of course, like all great artists, I have performed there. Yes,
indeed. You and Linda, the aforementioned Linda Marlowe, in fact.
Indeed, well, yes. Of course, yes. So she's not in this, but she's she's in a film I mentioned earlier. And yes, so I was the for those of you that don't know and care, which I'm sure is not a very popular Venn diagram. Last year was the 70th anniversary of Quatermass, specifically the Quatermass Experiment. So we did a live reading from the theatre at Ali Pally, and in which whose studio main studios, the BBC, were broadcasting live television from in the early to mid 50s. That's where they did Quatermass Experiment in 53. So the theatre itself is relatively newly restored in a sort of faded, elegant, sort of like managed decline sort of way. If you're unfamiliar with the space, Alexandra Palace is vast and, as far as London is concerned, relatively remote. Mm. It's not well served by public transport, but the property and areas around it is quite desirable. But more as a suburban than a destination venue. Consequently, bits of that's probably a bit harsh. There's a sort of a white elephant element of Alexandra Palace, and it's beautiful, but needs so much money to keep it going, and it's not the most sort of cost effective of investments. That it's always partially crumbling. It's a bit partly propped up. It's a wonderful space, a very magical space, and the theatre in particular. New development wasn't in use where we are here in the early 70s is particularly magical, even if the staff can't get the audience back in the interval.
Because at this point in the time of filming, it looks very derelict.
Oh, it did. Early 70s.
It looks a complete ruin.
Because now it is used for, say, concerts. I don't think it's the best space for concerts for sound. It's used for ice hockey. And it has a theatre with a regular programme, and there's bars in there, It's not easy to get to, and if you're going to do a big show, you do central London, you're way over that. There's no tube at Muswell Hill. You're about a mile from the nearest rail. There's an overground from the city, but depending on where you're coming from into North London, it's not the easiest to get to, which makes it suffer as a venue. It is a beautiful venue, and they've maintained the broadcast tower. Initially, that's where the BBC was. To make both radio and programs, famously indeed, in the launch of BBC Two, they had a massive power failure. They had to cut live to Alexandra Palace to keep it going. Back in 1967. But as we see it here, like so much of London, it was pretty much derelict on the inside. And I am right in thinking, aren't I, Dave, that the inside sequences are shot inside Ali Pali.
I believe so. Certainly, a lot of it. Yeah, the kind of the vast spaces, kind of with the organ and everything, is I don't know where else they would have shot that. So, yeah. And certainly that's the roof of Alexandra.
Oh yeah, you can tell that. That's indeed. Yeah. So it feels braver than I was to go on the roof of Alexandra Palace in 1971.
Well, especially then.
Yes.
So you and Lucio Fulci, there you go.
Together at last.
Together at last. Anyway, yes. So, and it's weird because they sort of like, oh, meet me at a church, and it's obviously Alexandra Palace. But then later on, they actually refer to it as Alexandra Palace. So I wonder if there's something changed or something got kind of cut at some point. But it doesn't matter because it's this spectacular location where she once again is accosted by the red-headed hippie chap, attacked by some bats. Manages to escape, although wounded. But the guy gets away.
I hate it when you're attacked by some bats, but you're being chased by a guy with a gun. Well, no, with a knife. Sorry, with a knife. Yeah.
Knife. Yes. Yeah. And the sound in that sequence is really effective as he's kind of banging on the door and the bats are attacking anyway. So Joan, the daughter, now goes to see the hippie lady because she's also trying to find the redhead, and she says she knows who the killer is, and so she's got evidence that's going to exonerate her dad. And so while the police are being told to check every redhead in the city, which seems extreme and
they're about the guards parade, aren't they?
Yeah.
For some reason, they hope presumably because it's an easy place to shoot. It's like, check every redhead in the city. I know it's difficult, but you'll do it. Not difficult, mate. It's fucking impossible.
Indeed.
How? Okay, do we have a list of every redhead in the city? Yep, we've absolutely got a list of every redhead in London, because that's how stats work.
Yes, exactly.
You just want to literally stop people in the street, because we don't have that on the census, shithead. that's not the best line of dialogue. Yes.
But yes. And then unfortunately, tragically, Joan, the daughter, is found with her throat slashed. By the male hippie who's now caught, Hubert, who is played by a German pop star named Mike Kennedy, or Mike Kogel. If you're a fan of the German pop band Los Bravos, he was in them.
Yeah.
I've never heard of him. And he kind of admits to killing Joan and trying to kill Carol, but he denies that they killed Julia. And his partner is the lady hippie is called Jenny, who's played by an American actress called Penny Brown, who is actually a dubbing artist, which is quite funny because in this she's dubbed by somebody else because she's got an American accent. But anyway, so at this point, Corbin has figured out that the killer was whoever Julia Dura was blackmailing about this scandalous affair that she had knowledge of. Which was potentially going to ruin Edmund's kind of political chances, apparently. So the hippies are kind of taken back to the crime scene after they've beaten the shit out of Hubert for a while. Because, you know, that's what happens in jelly. And he says, look, we thought that, you know, that when Joan came to see him with Carol, it was because they said that, you know, they knew something about the crime, and even though they didn't do it, they assumed that they'd get arrested if anyone went to the police, because, you know, they're bloody hippies. And they were actually there on the night of the murder, but they were so stoned off their faces that they didn't see who did it. All they saw was, it's the title, A Lizard in a Woman's Skin. Which is a great line. And so that kind of means that whoever was the killer is you know, sort of pretty much in the clear, more or less, because there were no witnesses. But then Edmund is found having shot himself and left a note that he is, in fact, the killer. And that seems to kind of wrap it up, except... So this is the big spoiler. Edmund's apparently buried in Woburn Abbey, which is fancy, so he must have been quite important.
I had lunch in Woburn the other week with the in-laws, so that's another place. And there's another... There's another connection I've got with the location to this place.
With the Joe Fulci. Yes. And Stanley Baker, so there you go. And yes, of course, so...
It doesn't really make sense, because whenever they're meant to have, like, when he's meant to have killed him, did he drive back?
Yeah, this is the thing. It's a fairly obvious attempt to exonerate the real killer, who Inspector Corbin has worked out is actually Carol.
Yeah.
Because she was having a genuine... sordid affair with Julia Dura.
She's also got that amazing hat in that final sequence.
She has got that, the costumes in this are incredible.
Yeah, their costumes are yes.
But then Julia was blackmailing her father, so she essentially, you know, did the murder as described, but because she saw the hippies and realised that they'd witnessed it, she came up with basically creating another dream in the same way that she's described her real dreams and her real kind of attraction and repulsion to Julia, in order to basically, if she needs to, kind of seed this psychotherapeutic defense so that she could get away with it because she wasn't conscious. But of course, the hippies were so fucked that they didn't see anything.
That's because they had those cataract things on their eyes.
Because they had the cat, yeah, and that's represented in the in the dream. And the only reason that the inspector found out is because she at one point mentions the phone call that Julia made to her dad that she can't possibly have known about unless she was there when she was making the call. And thus, justice is done, order is restored, and basically by sort of spinning a yarn to get away with murder, she's caused about three other people to die, which is really quite something. And yeah, what a great film this is.
I mean, it's really well shot. It has a lovely eye. It's great locations. The art direction is really good as well. And you've got those even in the not dream sequences. You've got the sort of cubist art and the Francis Bacon that suggests sort of like her mind is madness. All these sort of visual clues they're playing with. The plot is a bit silly, but nowhere near as worse, some of the worst. Considering we're talking about Giallo, it's fine. The police aren't ridiculously stupid. There isn't an out of town pair of kids solving everything.
Yes,
it has some level of grittiness based on the early 70s location. It's even the fact it starts with sort of the opening 7 or 8 minutes are just sort of, you know, sort of lezzing up for the male gaze. It has a maturity about it that a lot of others don't. Yes, it is still it is still a Giallo, but it's doing some interesting stuff. And this is the same. This is the same year as All Colours of the Dark.
This is the year before All Colours of the Dark. This is the same year as The Strange Vice of Mrs. Ward.
Ah, okay.
Which is also kind of a bit of a shift, because that has, not to this extent, but that is sort of a gorier, more explicit version of some of the kind of late 60s films. And All the Colours of the Dark, I mean, it's always hard to say, because these things come out and are kind of in development often so closely together,
sure,
but then they don't take a long time to shoot generally, you know, sort of, it will be like a fairly taut, you know, kind of 4-6 week, you know, shoot all in. So it's possible that this kind of did have an impact on All the Colours of the Dark, which is, you know, has a lot of similarities, certainly in the kind of use of the London geography. Although the geography is different, it is still very much that sense of sort of grubby 70s London and sort of...
Yeah, and there's some lovely shots down the sort of the gasometer and the basement of Alexander Palace.
Well, I always think, you know, the sequence in that, in terms of geography, that stands out to me is the stuff around like the Anchor Pub on Bankside.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and a bit like Alexandra Palace in this, you know, now it's something that's been very redeveloped and has a, you know, sort of a I mean the South Bank is ridiculous in terms of the development, and it's just part of sort of, you know, summer tourist hell, but at that point it's a pub in the middle of, you know, a bunch of disused docks,
the real no railway arches of London.
Yeah, they just randomly they go for like this sort of black tie dinner. So yeah, the really fascinating as a time capsule, but then there's something about them being seen through the eyes of someone who's coming from, I mean, that's a very different culture because, you know, Europe and, you know, it's hardly, but I mean, I feel like there was probably more distance in the 60s and 70s when it wasn't quite, you know, like you couldn't just hop on the Eurostar or like, you know, fly to Rome for the weekend. But there is still a sense of kind of seeing it through a stranger's eyes, which I think is really quite interesting watching it as a Brit.
Which is probably why there is so much sort of landscape spotting. There's a sequence where you go from like lots of low angle shots just to get buildings in with the same shot as people. So like, and then they pan down the Old Bailey and then they cut to the Albert Hall. And again, they're shooting Stanley Baker from a low angle so you can get the Albert Hall in. As he walks, it's also, you know, that the director is, regardless of what other agents say to him, is incredibly talented in what he wants to do. And I think it's the sequence where Carol's being she's being interviewed by her dad as he's a barrister, even though there's no instructing solicitor. So I think that's not allowed. But anyway, we'll come on to that as well. But they shoot it as it's like it's a close-up on Farinder Balkan, but the reflection via the window of her dad. So you see him next to her, even though he's opposite, and it's just visually very interesting. And there's lots of cuts like that as well. Gridman, I think at the end when Stanley Baker arrests her, they shoot them between. Between them there is a praying angel. In the sequence, and it's lovely. There's really taken time just to frame these shots. Mm. It's a cut above for that reason. If nothing else,
there's a similar thing at the dinner party as well. And I think because they have when they're eating, they have a glass table, so you see them reflected in the table as much as you do. You know, the corruption and the deception that's going on under the surface, because everyone is basically, you know, the married couple are having an affair, both having affairs. And actually when they do kind of at one point a split screen between the orgy and the dinner party, and they actually kind of put Julia and Carol in the same shot, kind of split screen, which is really just like, I mean, it's almost like, you know, that thing in The Prestige where they, you know, in the opening credits, they tell you what the end of the movie is. You know, it's kind of like, yeah, you know, it was them. It's really, really good.
It's just not, there's not a huge amount I can take the piss out of, which, you know, is, I feel bad.
No, it's one of the trickier ones. Obviously, there is the thing with Stanley Baker whistling, which is quite funny, where he's been given this sort of interesting kind of whistle, and he's clearly been told just kind of purse your lips because we're going to put that on afterwards because it has to fit with the music and we haven't written that yet. And then sort of towards the end of the film, he starts doing it and Florinda Balkan just looks at him and he just goes, oh, sorry. And he just never does it again for the rest of the film, which kind of makes me chuckle. But yeah, it's that thing. It's like, it's Stanley Baker. the sort of cognitive whiplash of Stanley Baker sitting next to Alberto de Mendoza, because you're used to seeing him next to, you know, Jean Sorel or, you know, George Hilton or somebody like that. But it's just like, that's Stanley Baker.
Yes, it is. It is slightly incongruous. But, you know, he did a lot of different things, Stanley Baker.
Yeah, he certainly did.
Stanley Baker. To keep the Nigel Neal film going. He's in the original TV production of The Creature.
Oh, he is, yes, that's right.
With Peter Cushing.
Absolutely.
But he's replaced for the film.
Yes.
Because that, when it was like, now you would watch it if The Creature survived. But in January 1955, you would watch on television Stanley Baker and Peter Cushing, who were both TV actors.
Yes.
At the time, rather than becoming major film stars, that they would be in Cushing's case, you know, about 18 months later. But, you know.
Indeed.
I mean.
Stanley Baker did also work for Hammer. He was in Yesterday's Enemy.
Yesterday's Enemy, yes. War Films. Yeah. Written by Peter R. Newman, who's a slightly mysterious figure, who also wrote for Doctor Who's first season. And it's one of those adaptations from the BBC, isn't it?
Mm.
And directed by Quatermass director Val Guest.
That's right.
It's very good. It's one of those stories. It's one of those ones when you watch it, you can see, oh yeah, this was a TV story, because there's not many different settings in it, because it could basically work as a TV play. See also Cash on Demand. That was ITV rather than BBC. But yeah, there's one of those. He's very good. Where it's about the strength of character that has to appear in the piece rather than the location. Mm. Yeah, but he's in loads of stuff. Do as well.
Yes, of course.
Long career. It's like How Green Is My Valley at the end, wasn't it?
His career. Yeah, because this was 71. He died in, was it 76?
About then, yeah.
Still kind of at the height of his career, but, you know, sort of died very suddenly. But now he's great in this. He adds a certain gravitas. I mean, and you know, it's that thing where, you know, they do at least let him kind of loop his own dialogue, because it's none of it's sync sound, but he does loop himself, as does Lee again, so you do get, you know, the sort of very mellifluous British accents. It does make some of the replaced dialogue stand out a bit more, but then everyone is kind of phonetically speaking English, so it does kind of work with the English track. So I think that is a good way to see it if you're looking to track it down. I actually have never watched the Italian movie, so I don't know what Stanley Baker sounds like in Italian.
But I'm glad he got a decent part, because when I saw he was the policeman, I was like, oh, he's going to be an idiot.
Yeah.
Like they generally all are, and he wasn't.
Yes. He didn't turn up eating a sandwich and completely fail to do anything.
Yes.
He's actually quite useful.
He actually solves the plot. I mean, it's like...
He does solve the crime,
odd circumstances, but nevertheless, he does the function he's meant to do.
Yes, exactly. As well.
But yeah, with an excellent sense of place, good performances all well. We haven't actually talked much about Frida Balkan.
Who is terrific.
Yeah, and she has, I mean, compared to sort of the a conventionally beautiful woman as well, There's something pleasingly sort of unconventional about Frida Balkan, and notably that she plays, you know, the witch character in Don't Torture a Duckling.
I mean, it's interesting how the different people use her, because in this is probably one of the more kind of conventionally kind of sexy roles, because she does have the scenes with Anita Strindberg, which are obviously shot in a very, you know, as you said, sort of, you know, male gaze-y, quite sort of erotic slow motion way. You know, the year after this, Fulci has basically got her as the weird, you know, wise woman who gets beaten to death in the village. And then even it's only like a few years after that when you get to something like Footprints on the Moon, where she's looking at, and I think kind of deliberately looks sort of much more kind of drawn and unwell, to be honest. Which is I don't know if that's a, you know, I assume that's kind of more of a function of the film than, because she's still around. I mean, she was, I don't know if she does much acting these days, but certainly, you know, she had a long career. So
she seems to have more to do than often a lot of women doing these things as well. I mean, sort of like, I saw one reviewer of her to say she was equally as happy in Grindhouse and Art House. I don't know how much happy she is. a lot of those as well. But you can't do all of that if you're not incredibly good at what you do. Here she carries the film. She has by far the most effort on the plot on her shoulders. And like a lot of films as well, there are a few times you look back and go, that doesn't quite make sense, but that's not her fault. That's as well.
Yes, exactly.
And compared to plenty of other films as well, we have
nothing but, I think, but respect for her performance. And it was interesting to see this is done before Don't Torture a Duckling, when she has much more of a character role than the lead role. But then Footprints is probably her, in my limited experience, is probably her best.
Mm.
But yeah, I'm glad to see she's still around, even if she isn't doing much these days. I assume in Italy, or?
Yes, yeah. Certainly the interview that I saw with her the most recently was in Italy. Yeah, I think 2019 looks like the last time she was in anything. I believe she's still with us. But yeah, I think pretty much retired these days. But yeah, I mean, you know, she had an extraordinary career. She's in some you know, sort of fairly well known, as well as she's in a fascinating film that kind of potentially influenced this one, which is called An Investigation of a Citizen Above Suspicion, which is sort of not really a giallo, but it is kind of a mystery about someone who kills someone and then sort of sees if anyone's going to work out it was him. She's in Royal Flash with Malcolm McDowell a few years after this as well. So yeah, she got around.
Good. What are we up to next?
Yeah, so I think the next one, we're gonna go back to the early days again.
So the
one of the great sort of scribes of giallo and Italian horror is Ernesto Gastaldi. He's probably written about half the things that we've done.
Okay.
And he had directed one film in the 1960s called Libido.
Right.
So that's
what's that about,
next.
Dave?
yeah, there might be some problematic stuff in it.
Oh, good. I have missed that. I can't wait to tell my wife. Well, what's the next film you're watching? Oh, Libido. Great fun. Always a pleasure. Well, I'll see you next time.
See you next time. Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/duesignori, where you'll get early access to episodes for a mere pound a month. Due Signori in Giallo is edited and produced by me, Dave Thomas. Until next time, goodbye.
You are witnesses at the new birth of Spinal Tap Mark II. Hope you enjoy our new direction. On the base, Derek Smalls. He wrote this.